Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
The FT.
Hello and welcome back to the FT Arts Podcast. I'm Neville Hawcock, the FT's Deputy Arts Editor, and this week I'm joined by the paper's pop critics, Ludovic Hunter-Tilney and Richard Clayton, to look forward to this summer's pop festivals, and along the way to ask whether pop itself has become too backward-looking, whether it has succumbed to retromania, as the pop writer Simon Reynolds' new book terms it. Richard, you're off to see the start of the Meltdown Festival on London's South Bank tonight. It's been going since 1993. Is this looking like a good year?
Well, I'm not sure it's necessarily a vintage year, although there's a nice tie-in because it's Ray Davies who's curating it this year. And, of course, somewhere along the line, he's going to have to be playing Waterloo Sunset, which is always nice on the South Bank, particularly in the anniversary year of the Festival of Britain. But the big thing is, in the build-up to it, has been a sort of will-they-won't-they rapprochement between the brothers Davies, obviously Ray and Dave. Dave said, I'll do it if Ray will do it. And this was, Ray said something similar a few weeks later. So the question is tonight, will they be on stage together for the first time since Lord knows when? I'm not sure, but that's certainly whetted my appetite for this gig. There's also a Kinks reissue programme just started as well. Their first few albums coming out with all the requisite bonuses and what have you. Ludo?
Yeah, I think it looks like it should be quite an interesting Meltdown lineup that Ray Davies has chosen. I think it's more varied than maybe one might expect. A great London songwriter such as himself has picked certain bands you would expect, like Madness. But then there's an interesting sort of there's a New York no wave theme with people like Lydia Lunch turning up. I never thought that Ray Davies would be a Lydia Lunch fan. She's a sort of 1980s New York avant rock noise terrorist, I suppose one might say.
How do we define no wave?
No wave is the brutally stripped down version of New Wave that began in New York in the 80s, in which all forms of melody were absolutely stripped away and a proper lo-fi racket was made.
Talking of brutality, they've got the Sonics playing, who were obviously a mid-60s garage band who played all those kind of old R&B tracks, much like the Kinks did to start with, but really stripped down and angry garage rock. So how they'll manage that in their advancing years remains to be seen. Even older than them are the Fugs as well, who were real sort of 50s beatniks who turned into sort of original hippies and played lots of very political kind of stuff. One of their number has died in recent years, but they are back and performing their stuff, so that'd be interesting.
Ludo, you're off to the Glastonbury Festival in a couple of weeks' time. Can it offer anything to match that?
Indeed it can, Neville. Glastonbury can always match any musical lineup that you wish to come up with. And this particular case, Glastonbury's got a remarkable double act turning up on the same lineup. None other than Morrissey, the singer with the Smiths, and the Wu-Tang Clan, the New York street rappers from Staten Island, who will be sharing the bill on Friday night. Interesting to think about the state of the dressing room that Morrissey might find as he comes along to play when it's been vacated by the Clan.
Not many daffodils.
No, and I don't think they're vegetarians. There might be a few half-eaten ham sandwiches. And I'm also looking forward to the headliners for Glastonbury this year. It's got U2, who were meant to play last year, of course, until Bono's back problems went and meant that they had to pull out, to their great dismay. But they are now headlining this year on the Friday. On the Saturday, we've got Coldplay. And on the Sunday, Beyoncé will be following her husband, Jay-Z, who headlined a few years ago. One of the things I'm looking forward to there quite a lot is U2's set for two reasons.
There's been some controversy about U2, hasn't there?
There are two reasons why. Is that U2 get a lot of flack for all of their campaigning, but Glastonbury is in fact the right setting for such a thing. But part of the flak which you two get for their campaigning is their somewhat opaque tax arrangements, which saw them move a certain amount of their tax business from Ireland to the cheaper tax jurisdiction of Holland. And they've been threatened with a protest by Art Uncut, an offshoot of the Tax Uncut protesters, who are threatening to raise up a huge bundle of inflatable money and float it between an Irish flag and a Dutch flag. And it will be very interesting to see how Bono, who's a chatty sort of a front man, will make of this.
So the campaigning band is being campaigned against?
The campaigning band is being campaigned against. That's exactly right. Pop will indeed eat itself, a theme we will be coming to later.
Indeed, yeah. Indeed.
And I suppose the other thing also is whether they preview any tracks from their new album, which they've been working on with Danger Mouse, I believe.
Interestingly, I'm glad you mentioned that, Richard, because it's just been announced that they've had to push that back. It's been quite a bad time for U2 lately, in fact, what with the fact that they've now become the focus of sort of progressive political ire. But also, their new album, which they were producing with Danger Mouse, but also Red One, who is Lady Gaga's producer, mm-hmm. has now had to be pushed back to 2012. The Edge has professed himself to be gutted by this and has said that whilst the tracks with Danger Mouse were thought to be doing the sort of thing they want, those with Lady Gaga's producer Red One, surprise, surprise, had not worked out quite as planned. So I don't think we're going to be seeing you two waving their disco stick in the near
or
future.
Or arriving in an egg or in a sarcophagus or something.
I wouldn't be so surprised if they arrived in an egg. They do go in for their high-tech stage, their high-tech stage routines. But no bad time for you two. It'll be interesting to see how they do cope with this headlining slot. I think they're at a crucial point in their career. And the other band, which I want to mention, is a personal favourite, I think, of Richard's, but not of Michael Eavis's, who is Glastonbury's organiser or co-organiser now. Eavis is unhappy about the presence of the Wombles on the lineup. He's not happy about that. He says there's loads of stages, and he can't filter everything which comes through. He said, I've got about 25 stages and managers and bookers for each of the stages. I can't control every single one of them, but I do get cross about that kind of thing, the booking of the Wombles.
That's a bit of a lukewarm endorsement if ever I heard one.
Well, there's been a riposte from Great Uncle Bulgaria, who Wombles fans may remember as one of the Wombles, who were ventriloquised by their creator, Mike Batt, has said that Michael Eavis probably doesn't realise what a fantastic live act the Wombles are. Uncle Bulgaria, says Blatt, told me he thinks Mr. Eavis is probably perfectly aware that festivals like his are so popular because they offer an eclectic mix for everybody. I think the Great Uncle Bulgaria is correct.
One thing I'm curious to ask both of you, since you're both off to see festivals, is do festivals bring out the best in bands, or are they best avoided? I gather that Adele, the very successful singer, is very unkeen to do festivals. She says the thought of an audience that big frightens the life out of me, and she will not do them.
Adele is an interesting case. She's been allowed not to play at festivals by her record company XL Recording, so she hasn't been forced to go and tramp around all of these festivals that she clearly does not like at all. But she is very much the exception. I think that the festival circuit is so well established now as part of the music calendar that bands have to go and either submit themselves to it, or in the more general case, do them quite happily. I've noticed that Coldplay, headlining Glastonbury, are also headlining at the Rock Am Ring in Germany. They're headlining at Tea in the Park up in Glasgow. They're headlining Rock Werchter in Belgium. They're also headlining Oxygen in Ireland. So in other words, each of these big festivals has got Coldplay turning up, and I might add many of the other sort of similar suspects too. The Arctic Monkeys are playing at them all. Blink 182 are touring Europe. Kings of Leon are turning up here and there. So it's a very important part of going out there and selling your music.
Well, Coldplay clearly have a busy summer coming up. Again, by a fortunate coincidence, we have a clip of Coldplay's new single, Every Teardrop is a Waterfall. So let's listen to that.
Well, yeah, this is Coldplay basically trying to do a hands in the air festival anthem, and there's been a bit of digging into the background of this track, and the piano riff at the start was originally in a 70s song, a sort of samba song by an Australian chap called Peter Allen, but it was also in one of Simon Cowell's early works, a 1990 very cheesy rave track by a band called Mystic, who was basically just a bloke with a keyboard and a model who wasn't even the real singer. So anyway, yes, it's Coldplay going for the Ibiza sort of anthem. I think it's extremely cheesy.
And we should also mention that the title is possibly the wettest song title ever, even by Coldplay's impressive standards. Yes. In that particular genre. It's called Every Teardrop is a Waterfall, which to my mind conjures row upon row of Coldplay fans turning on the waterworks as Chris Martin lets out one of his lugubrious yodels.
Yeah, well, and of course Chris Martin, known for his everyman sort of any interpretation possible kind of lyrics, but he's got a good one in here. He's talking about turn the music up, my heartbeat is my favourite song, but then he drops this one about I'd rather be a comma than a full stop. Which, I mean, if had that appeared in kind of prime 60s era Dylan, we'd all be, you know, trying to get to the bottom of. But
I think this song has very clearly been written with the festival season in mind. I mean, it's got a line in there which is utterly vague one and very unlikely, I might add. But it's, so you can hurt me bad, but I'll still raise the flag. Which, you know, heard baldly makes very little sense. But in fact, in the festival context, where you get people waving vast flags, at Glastonbury, if you see the crowd there for these big stages, there's a mass of waving flags. It's like some sort of medieval pageant. There you can see this line is custom made in order to get those flags waving all the more vigorously. It's a festival
and
song.
This song is a bit like Vida La Vida, the other one they did recently in the last album, but it's a kind of constant build. It never fully really sort of delivers on that build. And somebody said on YouTube, in the comments box, that it's sort of custom made for one of those sporting highlights packages on the TV. And it reminds me of, you know, sort of going into a gym, which I seldom do, but sort of being press ganged into a sort of step class or something. So that's another reason why I'm not a great festival fan.
You mentioned, Richard, the sort of, what would we say, the evolution of the new sort of Coldplay single. It's obviously reaches back, it's got various influences. Doesn't this play to the thesis in Simon Reynolds' new book, which I mentioned at the beginning, Retromania? The idea that, as the book puts it, that pop culture is addicted to its own past. I think perhaps we see this a little bit. If you look at the people who are playing at a lot of these festivals, at Glastonbury, people performing at Glastonbury, we've got U2 and Paul Simon.
B.B. King as well. I mean, there's a lot of...
There's a couple of things going on here, isn't there? I mean, the fact that obviously these old rock dudes are still around and still on the campaign trail
Bands like Pulp as well, who will be turning up.
Yes, absolutely. But also I think his point is that we've basically heard all the sounds that rock and pop can probably manufacture in that sort of 20-year glory period between, say, roughly 65 and 85. Pretty much every sound that rock and pop can come up with has been created in that point, that period of time. And now we're just kind of shuffling those elements again. I mean, that seems to be his point. And, yeah, I take up to a point, I think. What do you reckon, Ludo?
I think so he makes some very interesting points about the way we experience music now through the prism of the past, about the taking away of the shock of the new is something which Reynolds argues is been lost to today's consumer of pop music. And I think that the idea that this should also happen not so much in the mainstream, but also amongst people who would have once seen themselves as being avant-garde or types or sort of tastemakers are also very interested in the past and recycling it. Reynolds mentions an LA indie musician called Ariel Pink, who goes by the name of Ariel Pink, whom he likes a lot, who reworks lots of 80s soft rock and 70s soft rock and 80s funk type, very cheesy songs into a sort of hipster argo. But the fact that this has now become so all-encompassing, it does seem to me that it is, it's the way we experience our music now through what has happened in the past.
Yeah, I mean, Simon Reynolds is very worried about this this development. If I can quote from the book, off the top of my head, I hasten to add, he says, "This kind of retromania has become a dominant force in our culture to the point where it feels like we've reached some kind of tipping point. Is nostalgia stopping our culture's ability to surge forward, or are we nostalgic precisely because our culture has stopped moving forward and so we inevitably look back to more momentous and dynamic times?"
Well, I think he's conflating a few things there. I mean, certainly he is diagnosing a problem, I agree. I mean, but I imagine, you know, the Romans were nostalgic for the Greeks, weren't they? So, I mean, that kind of looking back thing has been there
from through all time in some respects. And certainly in rock terms, I mean, the first thing you say to a band is, you know, who are your influences? So, you know, that's always been there. And the Beatles were sort of aping early R&B. The Stones are doing likewise. There's always been people looking back. You know, Dylan was looking back at Guthrie, wasn't he? I mean, over shorter time periods.
Yeah, isn't his argument that at the same time people were doing new things, which happening now. So whilst in you had the Beatles doing that, yeah. I mean, you also had Pet Sounds.
Yeah, that's what I said in that kind of golden period. Yeah. But then he says he likes, you know, some of the shuffling of the other influences. I mean, one of the bands he likes is called O'Trix Point Never, which is a strange name for a New York electronica guy. And he has a nice phrase for it in one of his other guises, actually, where he talks about making echo jams. And he does a very interesting track. I think his band name is called Sunset Corp for that. And it's a remix of the awful Christa Berg's Lady in Red. But it's actually very, very charming, very hypnotic kind of electronic suite almost that he's put it into. So, you know, Reynolds is having his argument both ways.
I think that in a sense, we've seen the death of shame when it comes to music, that in the days of old, there would be types of music which were seen to be infra-dig, you were not meant to enjoy, like Lady in Red. Obviously, many people did enjoy it. They bought it and propelled it to number one. But amongst the sort of people who felt that their musical opinions mattered, the sort of...
yeah, definitely. I mean,
for them, these people were not to be liked. But now we've had club nights called Guilty Pleasures, which ransack sort of old hits from the past that were seen to be very cheesy. I mean, there's very little which actually... which people feel you cannot enjoy anymore.
This is true. I think the for example, prog rock used to be beyond the pale when I was growing up and punk was happening. It was ludicrous to like prog rock, but now the serious radio programs devoted to prog rock.
As your long hair and handsomely astute face testifies, Neville,
and my Hawkwind T-shirt. Yes,
yeah,
indeed.
That's right. I also think that there's quite a lot of good music at the moment, which is being coming out inspired by the past. Adele's 21, I think, is a great album, which is completely indebted to the past. I mean, Fleet Foxes are another interesting case, who sound exactly, more or less exactly like Crosby, Stills and Nash. And yet also, I think, managed to use that form of backwardness to try and think about moving forward.
Well, talking of Fleet Foxes, let's listen to a quick clip of their song Helplessness Blues, whose lyrics, I think, sum up some of the issues around retromania.
I was raised up believing I was somehow unique, like a snowflake, distinct among snowflakes, unique in each way you can see. And now after some thinking, I'd say I'd rather be a functioning cog in some great machinery serving something beyond me.
So this is the title track of their new album, which is the follow-up to their breakthrough debut. And the lyrics there describe a sort of sense of... wanting to be original. I was raised up believing I was somehow unique like a snowflake, and then acceptance of unoriginality. Now, after some thinking, sings Robin Pecknold, the singer, I'd say I'd rather be a functioning cog in some great machinery. And I think that this whole song is about the idea of recycling in a way which is quite interesting. I think that one sort of thing which could be added to Reynolds's retromania argument is that in an age when we have a glut of products, and when that glut of products actually appears to possibly be contributing to, say, something like climate change, there might actually be an interest, instead of coming up with new things, in recycling the old. Is it possible, then, that pop music, the ultimate consumer culture, could find a way to point us towards a post-consumer age, which would be truly progressive in a way that I think Reynolds would surely approve?
Only you, Ludo, could argue that picking over the remains of the past is truly progressive, I think.
Well, yeah, I'm not sure I'm going to get involved in, you know, speculating on that. But what is interesting is Reynolds does talk about how the whole kind of crate digger sort of enthusiasms of musos, you know, in terms of finding all those very unusual records, that's kind of become the real sort of modus operandi of what people do now. And he talks about the Bohemians becoming kind of curators and things like that. And I think that is true. And the sort of the way they operate with the sounds that they put together is salvage and citation. So I think that's all, you know, quite interesting. But with this point about YouTube sort of putting everything of the past there, I'm not sure if it's necessarily retrogressive as so much as a kind of eternal present in a way. It's just like everything is there, so you know, why not take what you want from it?
But then I but tie in with that, thinking about the launch this week of the Apple iCloud by Steve Jobs, who announced its launch. It'll launch in America in autumn and here in Britain next year. This is a scheme whereby you can remove your music from your computer and store it upon some remote server. They call it a cloud. In reality, it's some vast data silo stored wherever. And this will be a way of moving away from the computer as being a way where you keep your music, instead of which you'll be able to always stream it. It's also a way, although actually Apple will only let you do it to music you own, if you were to take the Spotify model, whereby you stream any music, are we then moving towards some future where we rent our music? We no longer own it. This is music that we simply pay a fee, rather like to a jukebox, to listen to, and we'll no longer own it. That would encourage a sort of eternal present, because we won't have any sort of music of our own.
Yeah, that's true. I don't know. I mean, I'm a bit of a Luddite, and I've always thought that the iPod was just a sort of glorified Walkman anyway. Although this does sound like it is a bit more of a step forward. But I hate the way they launch it. It's like the easiest way to manage my content. Well, this isn't my content. This is my record collection. These are my CDs.
Your content. CDs is a lot of dusty vinyl of bearded men with guitars. Well, I mean, your content needs a lot of managing. It needs trimming.
I'm very happy to manage it. That's part of being a music fan, isn't it? I mean, at least it always used to be. I can't get with all this
I agree.
Remoteness.
Content, it seems like a very unromantic view of music. Content, I mean, that we move delivery is all content is somehow secondary.
Well, thank you very much. That's all we have time for this week. The Arts Podcast will be back soon. Thanks to my studio guests, Ludovic Hunter-Tilney and Richard Clayton, and to you for listening. The Arts Podcast was produced by Griselda Murray-Brown. Goodbye.
For more downloads, go to ft.com/podcasts.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.